what's happening with Occupy Portland and energy and feed-in tariffs and struggle?
Well, I'm not really up to date on that, but I do know it has been introduced in some of the solution sessions, so
uh-huh.
I think it's getting a little attention. Hello, who just joined us?
Hi, this is John Sorensen.
Oh, hi, John. Hi, glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Good talking to you the other day. I owe you an email, by the way. Sorry.
That's okay.
I will get
we'll
you that information eventually. Okay. Well, let's give it, let's see. It's about five after. This is when we usually get started. So why don't we go ahead and I will introduce our speaker, Al Weinrub, who is on the call. And Al is a longtime activist from your bio, if I may quote Al, been involved in many social justice movements over the years, and most recently in renewable energy, from the perspective of how this transition can be used to benefit society and working people and the environment. And also the author of Community Power, a white paper on the many benefits of local decentralized energy production. And Al and I met about, over a year ago now at the first West Coast San Francisco Feed-in Tariff Conference. And I remember my first conversation with you, Al, was about the schism in the renewable energy movement between those who believe that we should move, that renewable energy should be produced in centralized central station production units, as opposed to those who believe that we should not ignore the potential to produce renewable energy locally because there are many benefits. So this is an issue that's come up in Oregon, and it was interesting to me to find out that in California the same kind of dichotomy is going on, and there's proponents on both sides. And also, I know that you've been an active member of Sierra Club. Anyway, with that, I would love you to talk about community power. Al, we're very interested to hear more about all the many benefits of decentralized energy production, and then we'll open it to Q&A.
Great, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks
you.
Very much, Judy, for that very nice introduction. Let me begin just by saying a couple of words about the organization that I work with called the Local Clean Energy Alliance, which is the organization that is responsible for publishing the book or white paper called Community Power Decentralized Renewable Energy in California. Because it's sort of it's the effort of that organization that largely informed this publication and was the reason for putting it together. I also do work with the Sierra Club in California. There's a state energy climate committee, and so I'm one of the 70 or so members of that committee, fairly strong committee actually, which takes up all kinds of energy matters, not usually in agreement with the National Sierra Club about most things, but anyway, a very strong committee in California. And actually, it's both my work in the Energy Climate Committee of the Sierra Club and the Local Clean Energy Alliance that sort of had shaped my thinking a bit about local renewable power. So just to speak for a moment about the Local Clean Energy Alliance, it's the Bay Area's largest clean local clean energy alliance. It has almost 90 organizational members, and its mission is really to develop a local clean energy on behalf of communities. So just a word about some of those perspectives that underlie the work. So in talking about local clean energy, what we pretty much promote is a notion of decentralized energy systems. And for a region or for a city or some kind of community, hi, welcome to the call. This is
Chris
Al.
Chris Nelson.
Hi, Chris. Welcome to the call.
Hi,
go ahead, Al.
This notion of a decentralized energy committee and decentralized energy system is this notion of combining demand reduction, in other words, energy efficiency and conservation, in order to really reduce the carbon footprint of our society, and then at the same time then developing local renewable power in order to meet the demand that remains. And then part of the system itself is the dance that takes place between demand and supply through, smart grid and storage and all those other kinds of things I'm sure you're all familiar with. But this notion of sort of what you might think of as a net zero community is a fairly fundamental piece of what the Local Clean Energy Alliance stands for. And then the other piece is that is all in relationship to the needs of a community. So we do, for example, every year a conference called Clean Power Healthy Communities, and it's a way of really trying to bring the link together between community activists and organizations, the environmental justice community and sustainability community and the jobs, green jobs and pathways out of poverty, all those forces coupled with the whole notion of local renewable energy and power and how those things really work together. So that's sort of the main thrust of the Local Clean Energy Alliance that has informed a lot, our thinking about energy. And one other sort of framework piece behind this, the notion of this book that I put together called Community Power, which of course is a play on electrical power and political power, the merging of those two notions. One of the other sort of framework things behind this was to sort of try to combat the notion of electricity or energy as sort of a technological or entity, a technical entity or something like that, unrelated from other things. That from our perspective, the whole question of energy is totally tied up with social and economic issues, so that we can think about energy as having both quantity and quality to it. So quantity is just measured in kilowatt hours or kilowatts or whatever technical terms, but the quality of energy has a lot to do with who develops the energy, why they've developed the energy, who owns it, what it's used for, and in the end, who benefits from it. So the whole, what you might call political economy of energy, is sort of an important framework piece, because it sees energy always in relationship to social and economic forces and the role that it plays. So that, so that was another sort of piece of framework that sort of informed this work. So in terms of the actual benefits of local renewable generation in particular, so we put out this book, Community Power, in order to try to change the whole discussion around renewable energy. For the most part, it seemed that when people talked about renewable energy, the picture that they had in their mind was a picture of big solar power plants in the desert or big wind farms and that whole notion of centralized power, because that's basically the only notion that people generally have of electrical power, coming off, just starting off from not thinking about it too much. They think, I buy power from a big utility, I plug a plug into the wall, and bingo, something just happens. And so it's very alienated from the whole question of how power is produced and so on and so forth. But the basic notion was, big scale renewable power. And the idea was to change the discussion so that at least at a minimum people could see, well, there are other forms. There's a whole other energy model that's possible. And this would be an energy model that's not dominated by the big players for their ends, but dominated by local communities to meet their ends. And so this gets into that whole question I was talking about before, the kinds of the quality of energy as well as the quantity of energy. So within that context, we decided, well, to put together a little booklet that basically compares big central station renewable power on the one hand and what we call local decentralized energy on the other, or sometimes called distributed energy, or just sometimes called DG for short, which means both. I mean, in this particular book, I use decentralized energy rather than distributed energy just as a way of focusing on the question of control, because centralization and decentralization usually has more to do with questions of control and ownership. So I like to use the term decentralized generation. So this book basically is an effort to, and I can say later like where you can get this. It can be downloaded online from the Local Clean Energy Alliance. So the book was to just sort of look at, do a comparison between decentralized renewable energy and big central station power, and in that context pointed to a number of very strong advantages of local renewable power, for communities. And the way the book is structured is that it first actually makes an argument that had to be made that decentralized forms of generation is actually cost effective with the big central station power. So a good part of the technical piece found in the appendices of this booklet basically show how when you consider in the cost of transmission, big central station power in California is really no more cost effective than local renewable stuff that's close to home, close to communities, smaller scale stuff. So just by decentralized power or DG, we usually mean 20 megawatts or less in size for a power plant. You go from zero up to 20 megawatts, then we mean something that's pretty close to load or pretty close to transmission so that it doesn't require any transmission lines at all. So the first thing was to establish that it's actually cost-effective, and then on top of that there is plenty of potential for decentralized energy, at least in California, for sure, both solar PV and wind, actually to meet all of California's renewable portfolio standard targets. So to just sort of get those things right off the bat, we made some arguments. And then to actually look at the benefits, the ones that are outlined here, without going into them in too much detail, but just to sort of capture what they are and how we frame it, is first and most important that local renewable power or decentralized generation provides a huge amount of economic benefit to communities, or can. It has that potential. That means economic development and jobs. And goes through a long discussion and shows some studies and that actually demonstrate the type of job and employment figures and economic development figures you get if you develop energy resources locally, especially if the ownership of those resources is local, and sort of tries to put forward a vision of community-based power and how it holds wealth into a community instead of wealth going out to big utilities, stock shareholders, and so on, and just scopes out these benefits that are essentially non-existent if you're talking about big central station power dominated and brought to you by your local power, your actually statewide power utilities. So that's sort of one of the key arguments that we make in the book. The other is that local renewable power really minimizes the environmental impact of renewable energy, and that's because most all of local renewable power is already sited, you know, in the built environment or on degraded lands or areas, you know, where land is already destroyed. Whereas the stuff that the big power plants that are built remotely are oftentimes on pristine wilderness areas or on agricultural land or places where just it doesn't make any sense at all to destroy land that has other values. So it's sometimes very hard to calculate the value of an ecosystem and how much society loses from the destruction of that ecosystem. But you don't even have to do that calculation if you build the stuff really close to home. So that's a huge advantage, and especially for organizations like the Sierra Club. At least in California, we saw that as a huge advantage of local renewable power. Another argument that we made that's made in this book is that for the people who are really in a rush to reduce carbon dioxide levels and I hear this a million times a day probably, is that you need big solar power plants because we got to develop this stuff really quickly and we got to move quickly and, you know, you concentrate the development and everything is going to happen much more quickly. The book actually makes the argument that that's actually quite upside down, that that all of the examples that we have really show that local renewable power can be developed much more quickly for a number of reasons. One of the main ones in California, anyway, is if you develop large central station power plants, you need big transmission lines to get that power back to load centers. And at least in all the figures in California show that that's about a 10-year planning and development cycle, not to mention the opposition that develops around the transmission line. So if you actually look at real experience, the experience of Germany and countries in Europe, or even experiences of in the United States, that largely the growth of renewable power, especially solar power, has been through small power production facilities and not through the large power plants. So we make that argument. So you get actually quicker time to market if you feel that there's an urgency in this existential question of survival on our agenda. And then the last argument, substantive argument that we make, is that decentralized generation actually provides for increased energy security. And not only because you have many sources of generation connected into a web, which is generally a more stable kind of system, so there's no single point of failure, but also argues that one of the reasons that big central station power is so insecure is because of the interests that control it and how they game the system. And it harkens back to about 10 years ago in California, where California's entire energy system collapsed because of the Enron scandal and the complicity of the investor-owned utilities in that effort. So it wasn't a technical question that.
Excuse me, Al. There's some interference on the line. Could somebody who's making noise mute their phone, please? We're trying to record this, and I think that would interfere.
Can you please give us instructions for muting? I'd be happy to do that.
Does it?
It's usually a star six. Does that work here?
I think that's right. Yes, I think it's star six. Okay.
That help?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No. Anyway, so just to wrap up this thought, so that the insecurity of large central station power is not necessarily so much because of the single points of failure, but because of the failure of institutions to really protect public interest or even be concerned about public interest and so on. So it sounds like there's still a little bit of background.
Yeah, it
noise.
Does sound like... There's feedback from a radio or something going on. So could people watch the noise they're making and just move their move it away or do a mute. That sounds better, I think. Okay.
Great.
No, actually, I'm still hearing it.
I don't know if it's feedback on the line or some other.
It just sounds like noise at the location where the phone is. Anyway, okay, go ahead, Al. Talk loud.
Okay, yeah, I can still hear it. It's sort of some kind of a background
noise. Yeah, some kind of background noise, so people could check their line. Okay.
So anyway, just to review, so those were sort of the four sort of major arguments about the benefits of local renewable power as compared to big central station, the huge economic benefits that can come locally in terms of building more resilient communities, the minimization of the ecological damage would occur from the development of renewable power, the quicker time to market, especially if you have the right kind of policies, and the increased energy security that communities will have if you have a more decentralized energy system and more local control. So with that, maybe I could just take a breather here.
Mm-hmm.
And see if folks want to interact with any of the sort of densely packed things that I've said in the last few minutes.
Yeah, I wonder if you could relate these benefits of decentralized energy production to policies that promote that and make that possible, such as a feed-in tariff.
Sure. Well, in this particular document, we talk about three aspects that we think could really help to implement local renewable power. And the three that were selected were somewhat a little bit California specific, but still probably have applicability. So just in terms of the order that they're described in this book. And so, of course, I mean, this book talks about generation, so it doesn't really cover policies around demand reduction, which, you
mm-hmm.
know, generally we think of as a really important piece of the puzzle. And I know in Oregon you folks, you know, have a much better system for handling energy efficiency and whatnot, but in California, at least the Local Clean Energy Alliance and also the Sierra Club advocate for a kind of energy efficiency procurement program that are administered by statewide entities, as opposed to our current situation where we don't have any energy efficiency is handled in a diametrically opposite way from energy generation. The utilities have all the control about what happens and whatnot. So there's a whole set of policies that aren't discussed here about how to move the agenda in terms of energy reduction. But in terms of on the generation side, what we have emphasized is one is a program called Community Choice Energy, which is specifically comes out of California law. Back in 2002, the California legislature passed the Community Choice Aggregation Bill. It was called coming off of the Enron scandal. And it allows communities to aggregate their electrical load, all their consumer base, and to procure energy on their own. Instead of having the utility procure the energy, the Community Choice Program can procure the energy. And the utility still has to do the distribution and the billing and the maintenance of the lines and service the energy. But it gives the community the choice of deciding where they're going to get their energy. And, of course, what that means is you could buy it on the open market to get cleaner energy, but more importantly, you could actually build it at home. So this is a big struggle that's unfolding in California right now, where we have many, many communities that are trying to set up community choice energy programs. The utilities are totally opposed to it. But the whole idea that by through this sort of institutional rearrangement of things, where now the community through its community choice entity or administration can sort of plan and scope out how they're going to procure, how it's going to procure energy for the purpose of, for the benefit of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that usually means a lot of economic development, the building, the build out of energy efficiency and the build out of new local renewable power and so on. So that's a major, we call it sort of a policy initiative, but in fact, it's more like an institutional rearrangement because it changes sort of who's in control and who's in charge. And within a community choice entity, you could institute feed-in tariffs or on-bill financing or all kinds of mechanisms for making the whole program work. The second major policy initiative that we advocated for was feed-in tariffs. And I think, you know, in California, we have net metering, and I suppose you must have that in Oregon as well. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, the major way that California, anyway, has tried to promote more local renewables has been through the California Solar Initiative and net metering type of laws. And it seems that from our perspective, net metering is not a bad idea, but it doesn't provide the potential that a feed-in tariff can for really changing the game in a very fundamental way. And that fundamental way is it basically, through a standard offer contract, I know you're all familiar with all of this, so through a standard offer contract, it allows the entrance into the market of new players, new power producers, and they can be small, they can be community-based, they can be cooperatives, they can be pretty much anything you want. And because it's simple and it's standardized, it provides an opportunity for small folks and community-based folks, community-scale energy, to compete with other folks, especially if the feed-in tariff is designed to encourage, that type of growth and expansion in that sector. So that was the second policy that we really tend to promote very strongly over net metering or over even virtual net metering. There's a bill in California that there seems to be a lot of enthusiasm about, which is a community solar garden bill similar to what they have in Colorado. And then the third sort of area that we emphasized in this book was it's not a policy per se, but it was just the notion that that communities need to demand accountability from state agencies for the policies for the energy regulations and policies that they promote. And so that's more or less a call to arms on the part of those of us who are energy activists to really confront the institutions in the state that are dominated by the large utilities and the large players and who time and again make decisions that favor big central station power plants, even natural gas-fired power plants or liquid natural gas, all kinds of stuff like that. So that was sort of more like a call to arms. So those are the three things that we focused on. We focused on in the book, the community choice, the feed-in tariff, and sort of demanding accountability from public agencies. And that pretty much follows what the local Clean Energy Alliance sort of does on the ground as well.
That's great, Al. Thank you. I think the problem with the interfering and the noise is someone who's got their who's on speakerphone. So could people not use the speakerphone, or if they're going to, mute their phone, please, because it really is interfering. Thank you. I don't think that person is hearing what I'm saying. Please take your phone off speaker, please. We're hearing kitchen noises, et cetera. Okay.
We all have experience about these conference calls where you dial in and then you fall asleep, right?
Right. Actually, this person is moving around too much to be asleep, I think.
Okay.
That was a great summary. Thank you of the policy aspects of this. Does someone else have questions?
Well, Al, I had a question when you were talking about the economics of locally distributed power versus central station power, and how you make the argument in the book that it locally generated power is cost effective. Can you quantify that a little bit for us, or tell us how, in what areas you found the favorable comparisons between local power and central station power?
Yeah, let me just tell you that it gets a little wonky, this area. But what I did in this book is I looked at the studies that had been done for the California Public Utilities Commission, or a study done by for San Diego in
I'll do it all
the city
by
of San Diego. And also a study that was done in preparation for a feed-in tariff initiative in Los Angeles, and sort of projections that came out of those studies and costs, both the cost of installation, but then the levelized cost of energy over a period of 20 years or so, and I compared those costs with costs that had been projected by the California Air Resources Board. So the things that I just had mentioned, those were all for local renewable power, decentralized power. And then I looked at some projections by the California Public Utilities Commission and the California Air Resources Board, who had put together these different scenarios that in trying to reach sort of RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard targets, and those were generally mixes of large central station solar PV and solar thermal stuff combined with a few other things, and they had some cost figures in there, but of course in their figures, they were not including the cost of transmission, so I found numbers that included the cost of transmission. So when I added together the levelized cost of energy in dollars per megawatt hour for the state energy agencies and what they were projecting with big central station power, they came out in the neighborhood of $0.25 or $0.30 per kilowatt hour. And then when I looked at the studies that had been done for local renewable power, which didn't require any transmission costs at all, they were very close, slightly under, the $0.25 number per kilowatt hour. So, so the tables and whatnot are in the book. But basically, that's what I did. I looked at all the most recent data and projections to arrive at that conclusion. Now, it was actually a year ago that I was doing the research for the book. So by now, for example, solar PV has dropped yet again substantially. So what happens is when the cost of solar PV drops, it means that for large central station power, the cost of delivering that power, an increasing portion of those costs is the transmission cost.
Oh,
if you think of the solar PV plus the transmission together, and the solar PV piece is getting smaller and smaller, then what happens is that the transmission piece becomes a larger and larger piece. So when you try to compare big central station power, solar PV with transmission to locally generated solar PV. Solar PV increasingly wins out because of that dynamic.
Very interesting. That's very interesting work, and that whole idea that as solar PV costs drop, transmission becomes relatively a larger part of the cost.
Yeah, they don't talk about it, but that's what.
Right. And of course, there's all the other arguments, but cost effectiveness is a big argument that proponents of DG face, because the common wisdom is that it's more expensive than central station, and that is
because
And that is largely because of, and this is an issue I'd like to bring up, Alan, it was central to the question that we had submitted, is the role of the PUC, the role of the Public Utilities Commission in these policies, well, especially through the in the feed-in tariff. Because one of the reasons, if you've got the Public Utilities Commission in charge of these policies, their mandate is least cost,
right,
as it is in Oregon. And so this is the argument that wins the day. Would you care to comment about the role of the PUC in California? And in terms of your feed-in tariff effort, is there any suggestion that this that an organization besides KPUC administer such a program? I do know in states where they have a feed-in tariff, for instance, Vermont and now Rhode Island, it is not being administered by the PUC. Would you care to comment on that? On that whole thing.
Yeah, so there's a lot to comment on here. So I think let me just sort of frame the discussion a little bit by the fact that our new governor Jerry Brown, in his campaign for governor, called for 12,000 megawatts of DG, of distributed generation, and that really woke a lot of people up, because that was sort of the largest number that anybody had projected. This is by 2020,
mm-hmm,
as part of meeting the California's renewable portfolio standard. So roughly speaking, to meet the renewable portfolio standard of 33% by 2020, we need about 20,000 megawatts of new renewable power. So when the governor came out and said that, well, he wants to develop 12,000 of that 20 through distributed generation, there was a lot of clapping that went around, in renewable circles, because, that was the major part of it. And in fact, he's sort of moved fairly aggressively. He had a conference back in July, in which he pulled together, his staff pulled together about 200 people to come to a conference to talk about removing barriers or obstacles to the development of DG. And I just mentioned this because this conference, it was mostly people who are in the business, in one way or another. People are either solar or other energy developers, or financial institutions, or the big utilities, and so on and so forth. But there was a smattering of other folks there as well. So what happened at this conference, and talking about the 12,000 megawatts, there emerged a pretty clear split along two lines. One line was, it was the utilities and the big energy developers who said that these 12,000 megawatts should be mostly in 20,000 megawatt size parcels, by out by substations, and the project should be decided through a renewable auction mechanism. That is, the state would say, we want so much power, and then businesses would bid as to who is going to produce, the cheapest power. So in terms of the way that side argued its cause, they argued that exactly what you were saying, Judy, is, well, the most important factor or metric is least cost of power, levelized cost of power. That's the thing. And the way you get there is through larger size generation, through an auction mechanism that drives that sort of, or most more closely mirrors market conditions and so on. So that was sort of like, and sort of ingenuously argued that least cost of energy meant the best ratepayer benefits as well. They've never really shown any disposition to worry about ratepayer rates, but in this context, the reason for having least cost of production was because of ratepayers. So that was one side, and that was definitely a dominant voice at the conference. But there was a smattering of other folks there at the conference, some environmental justice folks, the Clean Coalition, which is used to be called the Feed-in Tariff Coalition, which is national but based in California, very strongly advocating for feed-in tariffs. the city of Los Angeles, which is trying to develop a feed-in tariff program, and a number of other people, the local Clean Energy Alliance and whatnot, and they had a totally different argument. Their argument was, no, least cost of energy is not the metric that we want to use. We want to, you know, this is actually a social policy position, and so we have to look at other values, not just least cost of energy. We have to look at values like how many jobs, you know, are created, how it strengthens communities, where those jobs are created, what kind of economic development that takes place. You know, some of the arguments that I just went through actually were much more present in the minds of this other grouping of forces, and those were the folks that argued for a feed-in tariff as the way to sort of generate this type of stuff, even calling for installation size to be, if not limited to 1 megawatt, that there at least be a carve-out that requires so much of it, you know, to be 1 megawatt or less, and so on, so that it actually gets developed in the communities in a way that benefits the community. So, you know, it was two different groupings of people which had two different criteria for how to develop renewable power, and then, different sets of criteria for what makes that energy valuable. So basically, I guess what I'm saying is there's sometimes it surfaces and sometimes it doesn't, but there's a big fight in California about, you know, how the CG is going to be developed by whom and to whose benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So in this framework, then, there had been a bill introduced last year for a strong feed-in tariff bill in California, and spearheaded largely by the Clean Coalition and the Sierra Club, State Sierra Club. And Governor Brown said, take it off the table, that he wanted to implement his 12,000 megawatts, not through a legislative bill, but through programs that he was going to run through the California Public Utilities Commission, or that he was going to handle administratively. So most people interpreted that to mean is that he wanted to create a feed-in tariff, and he wanted to do it outside the legislative process, and that meant that it would rest in the CPUC. So that made a lot of people feel pretty uncomfortable, because the CPUC historically has been pretty much the lapdog of the large utilities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So one of the testing grounds about where the CPUC is going to fall on this issue is that there is a very small feed-in tariff, California feed-in tariff program that's being discussed right now. I think it's less than 1,000 megawatts, if I recall off the top of my head.
Problem with it.
But there are proceedings in the California Public Utilities Commission about what that feed-in tariff is going to look like, how it's going to be priced, and so on and so forth. And a number of parties are intervening in those proceedings to try to get a very robust type of feed-in tariff of the type that we would want.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, the utilities and other folks are arguing for the type of feed-in tariff that they would want. So I think that this is a fight that's happening. It's not going to happen as a legislative battle, it doesn't appear, but a battle that takes place within proceedings at the California Public Utilities Commission.
Oh,
okay.
That I've talked to at the state level has talked about any independent agency sort of administering a feed-in tariff program. It seems that it's just assumed that the California Public Utilities Commission would do that.
Okay, and is their mandate least cost? So will the argument center on least cost? Will the proponents of distributed generation be able to bring in the other metrics that you were talking about earlier of economic benefits to the community?
Yeah,
that's the problem
we
have here.
Yeah, in the proceeding, that's the fight that's going on at the CPUC mirrors the fight that took place at the governor's conference, where the utilities are arguing least cost, and everybody else is arguing no, that's not the main criteria. So no, it's not assumed that lease cost has to be the only criteria, and so the fight is taking place. Because, you know, if you really, I mean, lease cost can really cripple a feed-in tariff program.
Right, right.
You know,
exactly.
Basic bottom line, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole idea of the people who argue for lease cost. They're really trying to, you know, to make a feed-in tariff program just or unworkable or you know what I'm saying. They're just basically
mm-hmm.
trying to sabotage it in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. So a solution that's been proposed here is to change the mandate of the Public Utilities Commission to include
right.
a broader perspective.
Right.
But that hasn't gone anywhere yet. So.
Well, that sounds like that would be a good tact to take because it's a way of trying to reframe the whole energy question.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
energy is about, I mean, just not as simple as terms. Energy is about
right.
jobs.
Right.
So jobs are important. Then
right.
lease cost is not the only criteria.
So it seems to me like there are two solutions, either
yes.
change your mandate of your Public Utilities Commission or house the feed-in tariff in an agency or an institution which has a broader mandate. And that
right.
seems to be what they did in Rhode Island
uh-huh.
and in Vermont. And I
right.
wonder if that's – I haven't seen yet any – you know, any example of the PUC, of a public utility, state PUC having their mandate changed as the solution. So
yeah, well, those sound like good approaches. Just as a comment, you know, I think, I mean, we often argue, even if you assume a least cost, sort of type of framework,
mm-hmm.
I think there's arguments that you can raise, even within that framework, which the first being that, well, nothing is ever about cost. It's always cost-benefit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so even within the framework of least cost, you can say, well, no one ever just talks about cost. You have to talk about benefits as well. So that you at least pose that you can't talk about cost without talking about benefits. The other, for example, you know, talking about ratepayer bills without talking about the jobs question doesn't make any sense. What does it mean for a community that might be paying 1 cent lower per kilowatt hour, but no one has a job,
mm-hmm.
so they can't pay for that kilowatt? You know, they can't buy their energy anyway.
Right.
It's just too mm-hmm. narrow a kind of a
yeah.
perspective. And the other piece is that even when you're talking about costs, you know, they always hide, you know, the cost that, you know, that they don't include all the costs, right? So
mm-hmm.
when you're talking about cost of energy, you're talking about all kinds of costs, not just the ones that they're calculating.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the cost of the environmental destruction. You're talking about what I call the opportunity cost that's lost because it takes 10 years to build something or so many
mm-hmm.
years. I mean, any delay mm-hmm. is a cost because of greenhouse gas costs
right.
You know, just a broader concept of cost than what they
mm-hmm.
typically want to include when they talk about cost, to try to quantify, you know, other costs that aren't even part of the calculation.
Right. And transmission costs.
Too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you? Is there ever the case made of the avoided distribution losses for energy traveling over long distances?
That probably doesn't come up so much within feed-in. I mean, it's all part of the sort of avoided costs framework
mm-hmm.
for setting
mm-hmm.
feed-in tariff prices.
Yeah.
And actually, someone in Sierra Club wrote a very, I don't know if you've seen this, but there was a paper, a position put out by the Sierra Club that talks about the, you know, the how you calculate, what is the appropriate way to, or suggest how to calculate, you know, tariffs through avoided costs and considerations, and that actually gets to this kind of question by raising a number of avoided costs that are normally not thought of as costs at all.
Is that National Sierra Club, the paper you're referring to?
I can find it. No, it was put out by our state, our
oh,
energy
okay.
committee. Our energy committee actually.
Okay, I'd love to see that. I'll ask you for that.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I'll go dig that out.
Thank you. Other questions? Anyone else have questions? I'll raise the question then. In terms of building support for feed-in tariff programs, the groups that you mentioned, the Clean Coalition, the Local Clean Energy Alliance, and Sierra Club, has any thought been given in California to broadening the support for that, for instance, to labor, to the faith community, to other groups who are interested in this type of energy? I know they did that in Ontario, and that's why I asked.
That was actually a good model. The answer is yes and no. I mean, there's definitely people who understand that in order to achieve, any kind of a policy beneficial to the community, you have to really build a very strong coalition, in order to achieve it. That's not the tradition of the Sierra Club, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a new idea for the Sierra Club.
Mm-hmm.
And the Clean Coalition is largely a coalition of solar providers. I mean, that's their main base.
Mm-hmm.
It's people in the business. But I think both recognize at some level that their respective constituencies would not be enough, at least in a legislative battle,
mm-hmm.
To really win the day. So among, like, for example, I mean, the Local Clean Energy Alliance, has a different take on it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
everything we do is to try to build alliances of different sectors of folks to,
mm-hmm.
To build the strength of renewable energy. So,
uh-huh.
It's definitely part of our whole orientation to build very strong links to the environmental justice community, to the labor community, to the faith-based
mm-hmm.
community,
mm-hmm.
to, small tech business community, to commercial property owner communities, all these communities that actually have a stake in a more democratically controlled energy system and what it could mean for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And any takers in the labor movement in California yet?
Oh, this is a really tough one because, the labor movement is split along a number of lines. First of all, it's split as to those who still favor the old fossil fuel industry as opposed
mm-hmm.
to renewable, so there's a split there. And then even for those who support renewable, they're mostly dominated by this, a new Green New Deal kind of concept of reindustrializing America and providing huge numbers of union jobs. And that whole tendency sort of falls into the whole big central station power
mm-hmm.
thing because, those installations are union installations for the most part, whereas local
mm-hmm.
renewable power and its installation and whatnot at this point in time is largely non-union kind of
mm-hmm.
enterprise. So the unions have no interest in this in local renewable power, even though there's a potential for a huge number of jobs because they're just focused on, where they can pick up some work for their members
mm-hmm.
as opposed to
mm-hmm.
how they can really build a whole new sector that could actually, in the end, really help build the strength of their union, but they just
yeah.
don't look at it that way. So,
yeah.
We do run into a few people here and there within the labor movement who seem to have an understanding both of the power of potential of local renewable power, but also who have an understanding of the whole community dynamics where they realize that, we need to bring new people into the union movement through apprenticeship programs, through community workforce agreements and mechanisms for getting folks who are, in the more disadvantaged parts of the community,
mm-hmm.
Into a career pathway. So
mm-hmm.
those people do exist, but in the general sense, they're sort of few and far behind. So,
yeah.
We don't really have a program yet around trying to reach out to local labor unions and to try to build support there. But we have been talking about it a lot. We've talked about it a lot in the context of community choice energy, which is one of the things that I mentioned. And then that's sort of a framework. That is sort of more our framework for building these alliances that can translate into alliances that could also operate at a statewide level around feed and tariff policies and other things like that.
Has the idea of building prevailing wages into the cost spreadsheet for feed and tariffs ever come up?
I certainly have written about it myself, and I have basically advocated for that very strongly, both because it's the right thing to do, but also it's the only way you're going to get support for the labor movement for feed and tariffs, you know, at a minimal level.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're about out of time. Are there any final questions or anything anyone would like to ask of Al? And his community power book is downloadable. You can find it in the email that announced this call, the link to that, to his website. So I think it's very, very much worth reading.
Great. It's also I don't remember what there's two actually websites where it's available. One is the Local Clean Energy Alliance, which is download only, and then there's also it can be purchased hard in printed version, full color printed version for use with possible classroom use or whoever wants to read hard copy at it's called communitypowerbook.com.
Okay. Great. Looking through my list of questions here, and I think we've really covered the waterfront.
Well, just to say,
Thank you.
Really appreciate the efforts of OREP to push feed and tariffs from the perspective that you are, which I feel is very similar to all the things that I've been talking about here. And I think that's the only way to do it, to really be talking about the benefits to the community of feed and tariff on many different levels, and then the potential that provides for building a coalition that can actually achieve such programs.
Well, it's an opportunity I think we shouldn't miss, because renewable energy by its very nature is distributed, and because of that we can achieve these local economic and environmental benefits that weren't possible with fossil fuels. So let's not lose sight of that, this new opportunity that they provide in the transition.
Really.
Great. Well, if no one else has any questions, I think we'll adjourn for today. And thank you so much, Al, for bringing your perspective and your background and all the research work that you've done. I think it will benefit a lot of groups to have that background research group.
Great. Well, I'm happy to help out in whatever way I can today and in the future. So
we'll
keep in touch.
We'll do. Thank you, everybody. And this will be recorded on the website. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Al.
Bye-bye, all.